Today at Reader's Corner, Washington Post Associate Editor Rajiv Chandrasekaran, author of Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan.
What was an attainable goal in the early years of the war began to become something that was simply too challenging by 2009 and 10. The overall ability of an Afghan government in Kabul to hold its own may be less dependent on the number of boots we have on the ground than on our willingness in Washington to provide the financial support they need. We still have 68,000 men and women in uniform serving there. We will, all told, probably have spent $500 billion on this war. So I think it's incumbent upon us as Americans to really engage with this.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Few would argue that the end of America's longest war is a bad thing. But after nearly 12 years of combat and occupation in the arid mountains of Afghanistan, many question whether U.S. policy in this extraordinarily complex nation has achieved anything approaching its cost in blood and treasure. Today's guest, Rajiv Chandrasekaran, has seen firsthand how the Obama administration's ambitious effort to shift our post-September 11th priorities has fallen far short of its original idealistic intentions. He is the author of a new book, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan, that chronicles how American infighting and incompetence, as well as Afghan and Pakistani malfeasance, have largely squandered the ambitious surge of U.S. military and civilian resources into the war. Mr. Chandrasekaran is a senior correspondent and associate editor at The Washington Post and the author of Imperial Life in the Emerald City, a best-selling account of the troubled American effort to reconstruct Iraq. In October, Mr. Chandrasekaran was a featured speaker at the Frank Church Conference on Public Affairs. Rajiv Chandrasekaran, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Great to be on with you, Bob.
Well, Rajiv, the first thing I should tell you, I'm not so sure you would even know this, but there is an online newsletter called Inside Higher Education, and I opened it up this morning, and one of the first things I came across was your book, Little America, where it was reviewed briefly and said very clearly that if one book is going to be read on a college or university campus anywhere in America this year about Afghanistan, it needs to be Little America. And I say that not only because I want you to know, but I want our listeners to know that this is indeed, one of the most important accounts of foreign policy that this nation's ever seen. You've done a great job, and I appreciate your being on the show.
Thank you very much. You know, I did not want to write this book. I thought when I set out for my travels to Afghanistan in 2009, I would be writing a story about how the new administration in Washington, a team of generals at the Pentagon who had been enlightened and chastened by their experiences in Iraq, American diplomats and reconstruction workers who had also learned hard lessons from our debacle in Iraq, would do things differently in Afghanistan, would manage to turn around a failing war, would lead us to an outcome that we could, after many dark years, feel satisfied as Americans about, and would also do right by the Afghan people. And I don't want to suggest, Bob, that all of it has been for naught. We certainly have accomplished many good things out there. I question the sustainability, though. But overall, the ambitious goals that were set by our leaders in Washington in 2009, when we decided to send many, many more troops there, essentially to double troop levels in Afghanistan, we haven't met those ambitious goals, either for the improvement of security in Afghanistan, for the overall regional situation there, for the development of its government, for the reconstruction of its economy and its society. And to me, that's very painful. I hoped we'd have done better. So I feel like this is an important story for Americans to engage with, because it's vital to know what we have done and what we haven't done and what's been the true cost of this endeavor out there that still, even though our troops are coming home, we still have 68,000 men and women in uniform serving there, thousands more civilians. We will, all told, probably have spent upwards of $500 billion on this war that is now our nation's longest war. So I think it's incumbent upon us as Americans to really engage with this. We can't just ignore it, say, that was that, you know, let's move on to something else. We need to understand what we did there, what worked and what didn't.
Well, if you were in the White House in 2014, and you're a writer for the president, and you're asked to sit down and put together how the president is going to justify this war to the American people now that our troops are pulling out and we are leaving, what would you say?
I would say that this war began with just causes. It began with two fallen towers and a airplane strike on the Pentagon and another plane crash in Pennsylvania, heinous attacks that were plotted from Afghan soil, not by Afghan people, but from the nation of Afghanistan. And we had a moral and a national security imperative to ensure that wouldn't happen again. Now, certainly that meant a war against al-Qaeda, which we have prosecuted, I would argue, very, very well. We've killed Osama bin Laden. We've eviscerated the top leadership of that terrorist organization. But that's taken place largely because of drone strikes and special forces activity, much of it in Pakistan, not in Afghanistan. We wanted to make Afghanistan a better nation for its people there, to prevent al-Qaeda from coming back. But what was an attainable goal in the early years of the war began to become something that was simply too challenging by 2009 and 10. Had we not taken our eye off the ball to invade Iraq, I think we'd be in a much different position in Afghanistan today. But unfortunately, we made that grave mistake. I think that if I were writing a speech for the president, I would argue that though Afghanistan still looks violent and chaotic, the United States has achieved its key national security objectives. Al-Qaeda's on the ropes, and it looks like Afghan security forces, as raggedy, as uneven as they are, as you know, even though they're filled with some bad apples who are shooting at our forces, they may well be able to hold on to the capital and other major cities. It's not going to look pretty, but one might argue that it might be good enough for our national security interest. And the other thing worth noting is that at the end of 2014, I don't think it means every single American soldier or Marine comes home. The Pentagon will want to keep a small follow-on force there of special operations troops to conduct continued counterterrorism operations in the region, as well as some trainers to continue supporting the Afghan security forces. So it's going to be incumbent upon the president to make that argument as well. And lastly, Bob, the big challenge, I think, at that time is going to be, will we Americans have the appetite to continue providing some modest financial assistance to Afghanistan, for its army, for its government? And by modest, unfortunately, I mean, you know, a couple of billion dollars a year, probably more than we're giving to Israel in any given year. It's going to be a large amount of money, but far less expensive than the $100 billion we spent last year. And will we have the political will to do that? So the overall ability of an Afghan government in Kabul to hold its own may be less dependent on the number of boots we have on the ground in 2015 and 2016 than on our willingness in Washington to provide the financial support they need.
One of the fundamental tenets of constitutional government in our country anyway is the civilian control of the military, and the best example of that in modern American history is the day that President Truman fired General Douglas MacArthur. And ever since then, we always make it a point, the president always makes it a point to call himself the commander-in-chief. How does our perception of the presidency in relation to the military in matters like Afghanistan match up to the reality?
Well, I think what we saw in late 2009, as the president and his national security team were debating and discussing whether to give General Stanley McChrystal the surge forces he was requesting, I think it took us into some remarkable, uncharted waters in civilian-military relations in our country. You know, yes, the president is the commander-in-chief, but what we had here was the uniformed military, General McChrystal, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, then Admiral Mike Mullen, and General David Petraeus, who was then the head of the U.S. Central Command, all arguing for more troops in Afghanistan. Usually, you know, the way our system is supposed to be set up, you have civilians essentially debating the merits of various policy proposals. Should we surge? Should we not? Should we do it this way? Should we not? And then the military gets orders, and then they execute them. In this case, we had the remarkable position of the military, the senior-most officers of our military, essentially lobbying for a certain policy outcome. And it became seen as the military versus the civilians in the White House. And I think that set a pretty dangerous precedent. And it put the military firmly on one side of the policy debate, as opposed to their traditional role as more impartial executors of policy set by the civilian leadership.
Do you think that's something that has evolved over recent presidencies, or did this just pop up right in the midst of the Afghan war?
Well, I think it has evolved over the past decade, in part in the wake of the war in Iraq, when President George W. Bush frequently would say, I'm going to listen to my commanders and give them what they want. And so there was this essentially carte blanche given to them. Now, truth be told, the commanders didn't get what they wanted in the first years of that Iraq war, but later on they did. General David Petraeus got his surge in Baghdad in 2007. And I think that sort of set in momentum this expectation on the part of the military that they would be given broad latitude to define the strategy and the policy. And the civilian leadership was willing to allow them to do so to a degree. What I think surprised the White House was they thought when President Obama took office and approved 21,000 additional troops in the first weeks of his presidency, he assumed that would be enough for the military. And so was willing to say, all right, you guys go about fighting the war as you see fit. You can embark on a counterinsurgency strategy. But for the military, that wasn't enough. And it led to, I think, a form of sticker shock in the White House and a reexamination of what was the real sort of civilian-military role there. But you had a president, a young Democratic first-term president, who found it very politically untenable, perhaps, to stand up to the uniformed military in the first year in office. So when they came in and asked for more troops, he ultimately decided he'd have to give them much of what they asked for.
You're listening to Rajiv Chandrasekaran. He is the author of Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. One of the interesting things about this book and a piece of the Afghan-American relationship that I didn't understand really comes right from the title of your book, Little America, and the effort by America years ago to kind of move into Afghanistan and lift it up with the help of the Morrison Knutson Company. And for our Boise-based listeners, our Idaho listeners for that matter, as they know, Morrison Knutson, MK, is an Idaho company, or was an Idaho company. It still exists in another corporate form, but over the years it's built around the world. Tell us a little bit about the Little America project and what role that plays in this overall history of our relationship.
Yeah, this again is a fascinating element of the overall story and one that really has resonance for a lot of people in Idaho. You know, when I was preparing to accompany U.S. Marines in southern Afghanistan, I noticed all of these irrigation canals built, you know, wonderfully sort of straight north-south in some cases, great construction. And having looked at how other things are built in southern Afghanistan, it became very clear to me these clearly were not built with local labor, or at least by local engineers or designed locally. And I went about trying to understand how they had come to be and discovered this remarkable tale of America and Afghanistan. You know, most of us think that America's engagement in Afghanistan began with the 9/11 attacks, or perhaps during the years of the Soviet invasions in the 1980s. But in fact, it began in the late 1940s as dozens of American engineers descended on southern Afghanistan, at that point hired by the Afghan government. This wasn't a foreign aid project. They went and they hired Morrison Knutson, and the reason was the king in Kabul, who had made a fair bit of money exporting fur pelts to the United States in the 1930s, was very impressed with what we had done with the Tennessee Valley Authority during the Great Depression, and decided he wanted to turn the barren, desert along the Helmand River in the southwestern part of his country into a verdant agricultural oasis to create a breadbasket that would feed his nation. And so he looked to the greatest engineering company in the world at that time. He looked to Morrison Knudsen, which had recently built the San Francisco Bay Bridge and the Hoover Dam, and said, I want these great American engineers to come out and transform my country. And so MK engineers went to southern Afghanistan, where they designed a network of irrigation canals, built a couple of dams in the upriver hills. Unfortunately, the soil in southern Afghanistan was simply too saline, and so the hopes of really turning it into a breadbasket didn't come to be. But those canals that they built are still standing there today. Now, as to the title of the book, the American engineers, once they got there, wanted to build a place for themselves to live. They also thought if they showed the Afghans how they lived, the Afghans who were living in traditional rural villages might aspire to a more modern way of life. And so right in the middle of the desert of Helmand, we built an 8-square-block community, or these MK engineers did, I should say, complete with suburban-style kind of white stucco homes with manicured front lawns. They set up the country's first and only co-ed high school. There was a swimming pool where boys and girls would swim together, a clubhouse where there were nightly card games and weekly square dances, and a bartender who would pour gin and tonics. And the Afghans looked at this place and they said, well, you know, we really don't want to recreate this for ourselves. But they did come up with a name for it. They started to call it Little America. And that's where I got the title of the book from. And as I went back and read through some of this history, I felt that if we had only changed the dates and the names, we could be writing about some of our modern-day development efforts there.
Just recently, Rajiv, the Marines were continuing their deployment into embedded areas with Afghan troops, and there's been two or three incidents just lately, certainly since your book has been out, about Afghan troops turning on American troops. And yet it seems we apparently are going to continue sending Marines over to be embedded with the Afghan troops. I wonder what your thoughts are. Number one, just generally speaking, what kind of a policy is it that continues moving troops into an area where we're not dealing with the Taliban at the moment, we're dealing with Afghan troops? They may be isolated incidents. You can point that out if that's the case. But I guess I just wonder how long the American people put up with a policy that has our own allies taking us out.
Well, look, this is a very disturbing turn of events. And the reasons for these so-called green-on-blue attacks are several-fold. Some of them are, of course, due to the infiltration by the Taliban. But others are the result simply of Afghan soldiers snapping under pressure. Remember, these guys have been fighting now for 10 years. And in fact, you know, their country's been at war for 30 years, if you count the Civil War and the Taliban years and the Soviet occupation. So a lot of these guys are stressed out. And in a country where people have been used to so much fighting, little disputes often turn violent much more quickly than they would back here in the United States. So it's a whole host of factors coming together. Now, I'm not trying to minimize or condone this in any way, but it really hits at the heart of our current strategy. As we are pulling our troops back home to try to prevent Afghanistan from slipping into total chaos, the U.S. military strategy is to try to develop and support Afghan security forces so they can take charge of the fight themselves and they can secure their own country. Now, of course, that requires providing them a degree of training and mentoring because they still have a long way to go to be a functioning military. And that requires U.S. troops to work alongside the Afghans. And, of course, that is now in peril because of these attacks. And that's something that American commanders are working through, trying to minimize U.S. casualties, but also recognize that they have to work with the Afghans if our strategy to hand this over to them is going to have at least a hope of trying to work.
The CIA did an assessment in October 2010 of Afghanistan's nearly 400 districts. You point that out in your book. The White House officials, I think you quote them as saying that they were calling it a report card on the surge. What was the conclusion drawn in that report? And did that specific report's conclusion get much attention in the press?
Well, the CIA's assessment of the surge conducted in the spring of 2011 found that for all the pockets of improvement because of surge forces, particularly in the southern part of the country, those gains were offset by losses to the Taliban in other parts of the country. So where we sent more troops, things did improve for the short term. But in other areas, things slipped precipitously. The overall assessment, the CIA concluded, was that Afghanistan was trending to stalemate. This didn't get a whole lot of attention at the time because this was a highly classified assessment that was conducted by the CIA for the White House. I managed to reach people who had read it in the reporting for this book, and I divulge a lot of this stuff for the first time, although none of it now in hindsight has any operational impact. It's not like the revelations here will somehow harm our troops in any way. But what it did do for the White House was lead them to conclude that the surge had had some impact, but not the overall aggregate impact that military commanders had promised in their request for more forces. And it led the president to at least reinforce his decision to continue drawing troops out of Afghanistan. But it's something that the White House has never spoken about publicly because it cannot argue to the American people that we're pulling our troops out because the surge didn't work. That's not a politically viable message. So instead, the study was kept under wraps, and the justification from our political and military leaders is that our troops are coming home because the surge worked. It's a bit of hypocrisy there, but or some might say it's simply politics.
You're listening to Rajiv Chandrasekharan. He is the author of Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. I think anyone who understands our Afghan policy understands that it's not just military. It's about development economics. It's about bringing specialist into Afghanistan who can help, for example, in the area of agriculture. Afghan farmers grow new crops, different crops than poppies. You fault the U.S. Agency for International Development in one part of your book for its refusal to fund an Afghan program to revive cotton gins. I wonder if you could help us understand what was going on there.
So this takes place on the very same farmland that are being irrigated by the canals built by the MK engineers. And in the 60s and 70s, many of those fields were growing cotton. It's a cash crop. The Afghans knew how to grow it. They liked it. Yes, there were some government subsidies, but they would spin the cotton into clothing and carpets, and it would help to keep women employed. When the Americans arrived after the 9/11 attacks, the Afghans said, "Can you help us restart our cotton gin, to restart the cotton industry here? We don't want to grow poppies. We know it's illegal. We know it's a bad thing." And there was some initial receptiveness, but then the U.S. Agency for International Development essentially said, "No, we're not going to help you with this." And it's for a couple of reasons. One, the economists there concluded that cotton was not an Afghanistan sort of comparative economic advantage, that other countries grow it more efficiently. So be it. Afghanistan was never going to export its cotton. It was simply an alternative to drugs. The other reason was because of an act of Congress that was passed that prevents U.S. taxpayer dollars from going to help another country's cotton industry. It's protectionism for U.S. king cotton. Well, the White House could have gotten a waiver around this, given the national security importance of Afghanistan, but USAID never asked for it. And as I detail in the book, this was one incredibly promising opportunity to get many Afghan farmers away from growing opium-producing poppies, the sales of which are helping to fund the insurgency and creating all sorts of other problems, corruption, drug addiction, you name it. And yet, we were too focused on other plans. We didn't listen to the Afghans, and we were unwilling to upset a key domestic constituency here in the United States. And so we wound up not doing the right thing by the Afghans. Missed a huge opportunity.
You also refer to a program called AVIPA, and you use a term that I thought was a particularly tough term to use, but I certainly see what you're getting at. You refer to the burn rate and give some unbelievable numbers in terms of what we have been spending over there. I mean, anybody that wants to understand the deficit, we know there's a lot of reasons for the deficit, but boy, when you talk about $4.1 billion in October of 2009, I think that's where the number was at that point. Well, now it's 2012. I don't even want to think about what that number would be in terms of what the so-called burn rate of U.S. dollars is in Afghanistan. And I'm not talking about the military now, but these so-called aid projects.
Yes. You know, Afghanistan is deserving of international assistance. Let me be clear about that. You know, their rates of malnutrition, infant mortality, illiteracy, they're off the charts. They need our help. They need the help of the international community. But in 2009 and 2010, the prevailing view in Washington was that to get changes done quickly, we will just flood the country with money. Think of it as sort of a giant stimulus in Afghanistan. So in 2010, we tried to spend $4 billion on reconstruction projects. Not surprisingly, much of that money went to waste because it simply can't be absorbed in a country like that. I write about one district in Helmand Province. We tried to spend more money in that district over a year than the per capita income of every man, woman, and child, largely through this AVIPA program that I write about, which provided all sorts of freebies to farmers. But it wound up providing them so many freebies that we crashed the market for certain products, all sorts of other debacles. And not surprisingly, this huge influx of cash wound up exacerbating the very corruption we were trying to stem that has been at the root of so much that is wrong with Afghanistan's government. So it was well-intentioned bureaucrats in Washington, but they didn't understand the reality on the ground in Afghanistan and wound up, in some cases, making problems worse by their well-intentioned efforts.
I know this is a gargantuan policy and so many different agencies involved, but as I read your book, I just keep waiting for someone at the top, and I don't mean the President of the United States himself, but somebody in the White House who comes to work in the morning and does nothing but oversee and coordinate this incredibly ambitious effort. And I just can't get the feeling that there was the coordination needed above all these agencies in the White House to get this done.
Not only was there no coordination, there was outright infighting. As I detail in the book, there was essentially a war in Washington between the State Department and the White House over aspects of our war policy, particularly the issue of not just whether, but how we go about trying to approach the Taliban to try to get to the prospect of eventual peace talks with them, that there is a way to sort of end this war, perhaps through negotiation, through a grand sort of program of reconciliation among all the factions in Afghanistan. Well, the State Department had its point man, Richard Holbrooke, the late veteran diplomat who had ended the war in the Balkans and had served in Vietnam. Well, the White House didn't like him, and senior advisors to the president sought to marginalize and minimize Holbrooke's efforts at every turn. And so for a year and a half, essentially, Washington was at war with itself over the subject of reconciliation, as opposed to presenting a cogent policy that was aimed at trying to end this war. We squandered the first year and a half of the troop surge because of bickering in our nation's capital.
President Obama has just been reelected to his second term. Does his Afghan policy get adjusted or fine-tuned in any way now that the election is over and he is free to go about his ambitious goals for a second term?
I think what you will see is a fairly substantial troop drawdown next year. Obviously, we're going from 68,000 now to a small stay-behind force by the end of 2014, but I think we'll see a very significant drop-off next year.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran, we certainly appreciate your joining us today for Reader's Corner.
Thank you.
Again, the name of the book is Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. Next week, Matthew Algio, author of The President is a Sick Man, wherein the supposedly virtuous Grover Cleveland survives a secret surgery at sea and vilifies the courageous newspaper man who dared expose the truth. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.